Hello and welcome to Kaleidoscope, a podcast series from the Science AAAS Custom Publishing Office, brought to you by AppCam, in which we will explore stories of scientific encounters that lead to incredible outcomes. My name is Sean Sanders. There is a proverb that states, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. Although popular culture likes to venerate the lone scientist making the improbable breakthrough discovery, this doesn't reflect the true nature of the scientific endeavor today. Rather than being built by solitary scientists working late into the night, science is a highly collaborative enterprise that depends on cooperation and teamwork for mutual benefit. In this series, we're exploring how connections within the community, whether serendipitous or intentional, drive understanding and progress to new heights. How the journey to a new discovery can be as exciting and inspiring as the discovery itself, and how the personal stories and passions of the scientists create a vibrant community that makes progress happen. I'm delighted today to have Dr. Linda Griffith on the line. Linda is the director of the Center for Gynopathology Research at MIT, and is going to share with us some fascinating personal experiences and insights from her 30-plus years of working with all manner of colleagues across multiple disciplines. Linda, it's my pleasure to welcome you to this conversation.
Hi, Sean. It's really great to be here today. Thanks for inviting me.
Linda, you have a fascinating and somewhat unique story about a particularly, shall we say, personally successful collaboration. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I've had a lot of collaborations in my career. I'm very social, and I also tend to work on big thorny problems that need teams. But the most important, arguably, is that one that started when I was an assistant professor at MIT, and I was a chemical engineer, but trying to build tools to manipulate biology for tissue engineering. And there weren't many chemical engineers doing biology. And I came across papers by Doug Laufenberger, who was at Illinois at the time, and he was a revelation because he was working with biologists to characterize quantitatively all kinds of receptor-mediated phenomena and describe them with math in ways that were just both beautiful and very useful. So I went to a Gordon conference, met him, invited him for a seminar at MIT, and that led to a lifelong collaboration. He ended up moving to MIT to start a new program connecting engineering and biology. We shared a lab during his first few months here. The students loved that because he's really a pioneer in systems biology, quantitative biology. My lab makes things. We need those design principles. It was really a great match scientifically. So we kept a joint lab, joint group meetings, because it was so beneficial to all of the students and postdocs. And we started co-advising students and postdocs, had really high impact papers together. And we ended up getting married and starting a new department at MIT together. So both research and teaching have been a lifelong venture for us.
Wow, that's a fantastic story. So I'm interested to know what you think this one-of-a-kind partnership in the truest sense of the word has taught you about collaborating and about finding the right people to collaborate with?
So I think a lot of scientists, certainly ones I collaborate with, are consumed by solving some kind of problem. And they are immersed in it, they build a worldview and try to communicate it and make the world a better place. So when I encounter people who are passionate about the things they're doing and their work teaches me something. So almost all the collaborations I have, I look for people who are really, really engrossed with what they're doing, but in a way that they're very good at teaching it to other people. And they want to be part of a team because they want to transmit knowledge. So they want to do something, the whole is bigger than the sum of the parts, because they learn something from you. And in my collaboration with Doug, for example, we had something to give each other and something to take from each other. And every collaboration I've had that's been successful has been that really great two-way street. And sometimes, obviously, you have teams, so it's even bigger than that. But you're always learning and you're always teaching.
I feel like it's a human tendency to want to work with people with whom we share a lot, but it sounds like you actually seek out people who are doing very different work. Is that true? And if so, Why do you think you do that?
So I wouldn't say I don't share a lot with Doug, because I think the personal connections are very important. So intellectually, we have very distinct spheres, different worldviews, different ways of looking at problems. There's no fighting over who's going to do what, because we gravitate toward different ends of the problem, which is great. It means we can see each other all day, every day, and never run out of things to talk about. And that's true with all my great collaborations. But I think at a personal level, there has to be some strong connection. So, for example, when I met Doug at a Gordon conference, I was astounded to learn in the bar eating popcorn and drinking beer at the poster session at night that he had read a book that I didn't know anybody else who had read, The Moviegoer by Walker Percy. Nobody read that book. It was one of my favorite books. And many, many connections are built like that. My fabulous orthopedic surgery collaborator, George Mushler, his wife is an artist. And I was immediately attracted to her art, and I became a collector of hers. And she and I are super close friends. Alan Wells, another fabulous collaborator at UPIT, he is hilariously funny in a way. He can make a joke out of the worst situation. Terrible things happen, and he finds a way to make me laugh. So connecting to people at a personal level and liking them is, for me, an important part of the collaboration. I have a hard time collaborating with people I can't have beer with or take a walk around the river with or whatever.
So that actually brings me nicely to my next question, which is, are there any types of people or characteristics of people that you might avoid when you're thinking about working with somebody?
Oh, yeah. And you learn this the hard way. But I've noticed this more and more in so many of my colleagues. The ones who talk very highly of their people close to them tend to be very good collaborators because they are sensitive to the ways people work. And those who are disparaging of people close to them often are very selfish, prima donna, and terrible collaborators. And I have discovered that I've worked with some people who were famous, but also tended not to be that considerate. And it's just not fun and it's not productive. And there's plenty of really smart people out there who are very humble. For me, I have a hard time working with people who are very selfish because often they're insecure. And that insecurity manifests in trying to always be the top dog in the room. And often you just can't have a top dog.
Now, have you found that as a woman, especially in engineering, that it's easier or more difficult to form connections across the scientific community?
Oh, I think it's easier. Oh my gosh. I remember when I was an assistant professor, I moved departments. I was hired originally in a program with Harvard Med School. I resigned and moved into chemical engineering. And we clearly needed a new direction in bioengineering at MIT. And I ended up chairing an interdepartmental committee on bioengineering education. And this led actually to recruiting Doug to MIT. But I could go all over MIT and people would tell me all kinds of things because they didn't think I had any power. You know, they would tell me stuff and then I could collect all this information and people were always willing to give me advice. And so it actually gave me an enormous advantage in just collecting great information from around MIT. And the willingness of people to give advice is a huge, huge thing, especially, you know, I think at MIT, we're good at mentoring junior people in general. So maybe it was that, but I certainly felt like people were very, very generous to me when I was coming up through the ranks overall.
Well, it seems clear to me that the life science community is made stronger as more women take up positions of greater influence and power. Do you have any thoughts about this? And what else does the community need to do to accelerate more women into positions of influence?
First of all, some of the worst things that have happened to me professionally have been things that women did, who maybe they were insecure or jealous or whatever. So I wouldn't say that necessarily equating having more women as being better overall, because I think overall, I have so many amazing male colleagues and there's an equal distribution of, kind of good and bad. But I'll say, I think I'm in an unusual place right now because one of my other amazing collaborations is with Keith Isaacson, a surgeon at Newton Wellesley, who's operated on me 4 times for endometriosis and who dragged me into working on endometriosis professionally after I had a very well-established career otherwise. And this was scary because there's not much funding in gynecology. and I knew nothing about it. Doug, my husband, jumped in with me. He thought it was a great application of systems biology. So I'd say the important thing is a lot of diseases that preferentially afflict women are very under the radar and underfunded, understudied, and they're not respectable. There's a stigma around menstruation. I think there should be something called menstruation science. And I think having women in the room elevates just awareness about these fascinating problems that we've been missing for so many years. So I wouldn't say that the overall enterprise necessarily will change dramatically, but I think having problems that women are excited about working on because they can see these problems and how practical it would be to solve these problems for society. I think that is one huge thing women can bring. It certainly, I've become a very strong advocate for women's reproductive health in my research community, particularly engineering. And I really credit Keith Isaacson for sticking with us, coming to MIT and teaching students about gynecology, inviting us into his operating room and so on.
So thinking a little bit more broadly, advancement in science is very much about community and everyone working towards a common goal, or at least groups working towards a common goal. How do you think about this and about ways to build a stronger scientific community?
I love this question so much because I tell this to my lab every day. One of the things is know who you are and who you're not and what your role in the ecosystem is. And I am an engineer, and part of what I do is try to build tools that will enable biology. So, for example, we developed a synthetic extracellular matrix to replace Matrigel for organ epithelial organoid culture. This is a hugely useful tool, and my advocacy for women's health is I share this matrix with all the people doing endometrial biology that I possibly can. We're in the process of commercializing it, but I sent it to collaborators around the world because I want that level of biology to be better. And we share data with each other. We visit each other. There's a real strong sense of community. Everybody has something to contribute, and everybody can get something from the community.
Your work means that you are interacting with researchers in the lab, clinicians in hospitals, and also patients. How have these connections brought value to your work?
So connections across the entire food chain, if you will, from very basic scientists to the clinicians, patients, and industry collaborators, who I have a lot of industry collaborators. It's essential, certainly on the patient front. I get emails from patients almost every single day, and it is both heartbreaking and inspiring. I get up in the morning knowing there are young girls in my community who can't even go to class and teenagers who can't go to class. And I'm pushing to try to get a new drug into the clinic. So I'm constantly interacting with industry collaborators, urging them to start programs in new areas with some success, actually. And the clinicians, it's really essential because they're the gate to the patient. I go to the surgery meetings. I'm one of the few scientists who goes to gynecology surgery meetings, but they tell me all kinds of things just in casual conversation that you can't learn in papers. And it really sometimes changes my entire worldview and an offhand conversation someone will make at a conference in the hallway. So it's important to keep that spectrum as an engineer. And you know, this is the role of engineers to define those problems and grab from science to try to solve them.
If you were to give your younger self a piece of advice that might better prepare them to develop successful ways of working with others in the scientific community and building that scientific community, what do you think that might be?
I think know who you are and who you're not and manage expectations in the collaboration. You know, the old saying, good fences make good neighbors. Really define who's going to do what in a really thoughtful way. You know, if you have a joint NIH grant, who's going to write the progress report? Who's going to take the, you know, all of the little things that you don't want expectations to be, oh, I thought you were doing this, and have the collaboration become an endless litany of those kinds of things. So the devil is in the details and being, you know, really upfront with what you can do and what you expect someone else to be able to do and to follow through on doing is super important. And I've been guilty of not over inflating what I can do. And if you're in a great collaboration, you realize it and you make up for it, but sometimes it can go bad. And I've been in collaborations where people outright lied to me about what they could do and they knew it. And it was really awful and ended up in legal territory. So managing expectations and making that very clear from the outset is probably the biggest thing, especially in large collaborations there where there are teams and you have younger people who really need to worry about authorship and who's going to be first author and so on.
So one final question for you. You talked about being an extrovert. I'm an introvert personally. I think that's what brought me into science. And my impression is that there's a lot of introverts in the sciences and engineering. Is that your experience? And do you find that your extroversion can bring out those introverts and get them better into the conversation?
Oh, what a great question. Yes, absolutely. I'm a surfactant for a lot of people. My husband's an introvert, and many of my collaborators have been very strong introverts. And often their wives are extroverts. So I often stay at people's houses. I get to know the whole family, and often the wives and I get to be very close friends. But you made a great point, and that's for sure the case in my experience.
Well, Linda, it's been a real delight talking to you. Thank you so much for making the time.
It's so great you're doing this podcast. I'm thrilled that you invited me. Thank you for having me.
Our thanks to Abcam for supporting this podcast. Abcam believes that progress happens together through the creation of a connected and supportive scientific community. To learn more about how you can progress with Abcam, go to abcam.me/together. I'm Sean Sanders. Thank you for listening.